assembly wills it thus, you shall soon wear the crown. I am Gundrabo's deputy, and I will speak for the secondlings."
He gestured for Gundagar to take his place at the table. Gundagar sat down, and Bislapur took up position behind him. The fourthling monarch leaned over to inspect the maps, only to realize that some of the delegates were staring at him expectantly. They seemed to be waiting for him to stake his claim more roundly, but Bislapur had warned him against showing his hand too soon. His priority was the situation in the north of Gurdlagard, and he was eager to see how his proposal would be received.
"Where are the 9 clans of Berengar's folk?"
he asked, nodding toward the empty seats belonging to the firstlings.
"Not here?"
Melendalin shook his head.
"No, and we don't know if they're coming. We've heard nothing from the firstlings for 200 cycles."
He reached for his axe and lowered the blade over the far west of Gurdlagard. The dwarves of Berengar's folk were the keepers of the Silver Pass, the defenders of the Red Range against invading troops. The human realm of Queen Wei the Fourth separated their kingdom from the rest of Gurdlagard.
"We know they're still there, though. According to the merchants of Weyern, the Silver Pass has not been breached."
He laid his axe on the table.
"It's their business if they choose to stay away. We must vote without them."
The other members of the assembly murmured their assent.
"King Gandogar, you wish to ascend the throne, but first you must hear of the challenges that await you. The perished land is creeping through Gurdlagard. Every pace of land conquered by Teon's minions is infected with a terrible force that turns nature against itself. Its power is such that even the trees become intent on attacking and killing anything that lives. People say that those who perish on this ground return to life without a soul or a will. The dead become enslaved to the dark power and join the orcs in slaying their kin."
"The perished land is advancing?"
Gundagar took a deep breath. It was clear from the councillor's words that the Magi had failed to stem the tide of evil.
"I never trusted the Lungan's magic," he said heatedly. "All those fancy fireworks, and to what end? Nudin, Lotionin, Andokai, and the rest of them are too busy perfecting their magic with their 2 clever-by-half apprentices. They scribble away in their laboratories and castles, studying the secrets of elven immortality, so they can scribble and study and scribble some more. And all the while, the perished land is creeping forward like rust on metal that no one has remembered to treat."
His blunt words met with noisy approval.
"At least some good has come of it. The elves have been all but annihilated."
Gandagar's heart leapt at the thought that the arrogant elves would soon meet their doom. It was his firm intention that he and his warriors would inflict the final blow. The elves had murdered his father and brother, but now the time of reckoning was near.
"Soon the feuding and fighting will be over once and for all."
He was itching to tell the others of his plan.
"All but annihilated?"
echoed Belendalin, frowning.
"Elders and chieftains, this is joyful news indeed."
Gandagar's cheeks were flushed, and his brown eyes shone with enthusiasm.
"Fracas has given us the means to wipe out the children of Sitalia. The last of their race are gathered here."
His index finger stabbed at the small dot on the map representing all that remained of the elven kingdom.
"Listen to what I propose. Let us form a great army, march on Alandur, and extract our vengeance for deeds that have gone unpunished for cycles."
The delegates stared at him, dumbfounded. Bislapur's surprise tactics had worked.
"Gandogar, we gathered here today to elect a new High King,"
Belendalin said evenly, trying to deflate the excitement. It was clear from the murmured conversations that the Fourthling King's proposal had struck a chord.
"It is not for us to talk of war with the elves. Our duty is to protect the peoples of Gurdlagard."
He turned imploringly to the benches.
"Friends, remember the commandment given to us by Vrakas."
Gandagar scanned the faces of the delegates. He could see that they were torn.
"First listen to what I have to say. Documents have come into my possession. Ancient documents, uncovered by Bislapur, and handed to me. Hear what they speak of, then decide for yourselves what should be done."
He took a deep breath, unfurled a roll of parchment, and read in a solemn voice.
And the elves were filled with envy. Desirous of the dwarven treasure, they fell upon the Fifthling Kingdom and ambushed Giselbert's folk. Fierce fighting broke out in the underground halls and at the stone gateway. Some of the enemy were trapped by Giselbert in a gloomy labyrinth, never to be seen again. But the treacherous elves used their magic to poison the children of the smith. One by one, the Fifthlings succumbed. The elves seized their chance and slaughtered the ailing dwarves. Only a handful of Giselbert's folk escaped the massacre.
Silence descended on the great hall. Gandalgar's words echoed in the minds of his listeners, his commanding voice breathing new life into the ancient script.
Drawn by the smell of death and bloodshed, orcs and trolls marched on the stone gateway and gathered at the border. The cowardly elves fled in terror, abandoning Girdlygard to its fate. But before they fled, they used their cunning to open the portal. Giselbert and his remaining warriors defended the pass with the staunchness of true dwarves, but their depleted army could do nothing against the hordes. It was then that evil entered Girdlygard.
He paused to measure the force of his speech. With a little more persuasion, he would have them on his side. Only Gundrabur's one-armed counselor was shaking his head.
I do not trust these lines, King Gandalgar. Why were they not discovered before now? It seems strange that a document incriminating the elves should emerge at this time. It suits your purpose rather well. The document was hidden. Who knows for what purpose? Perhaps by a doubting dwarf like yourself, who lacked the conviction to go to war,
came Gandagar's scornful reply. He raised his axe and buried the blade in the map, cleaving Alandur.
You heard what the document says. They killed our kin and betrayed us. They must pay for their murderous deeds.
And then what?
Melendalin asked harshly.
Tell me, King Gandagar, who would benefit from the destruction of the elves? Their deaths won't further our interests, nor those of mankind. No, destroying Alandor will profit the perished land alone. We may as well join forces with the Alpha and help them to victory. Is that what you want?
The counselor fixed his eyes on Gandalgar, who suddenly felt dangerously exposed.
Our real enemies aren't the elves, your majesty. Vrakas didn't give us the authority to fight the peoples of Girdlygard. By my beard, none of us can stand the elves. It's in our nature not to like them. There have been skirmishes, even deaths, I know.
He placed a hand on his left shoulder.
I lost a limb in a fight with four orcs. But I'd sooner sever my one good arm than raise it in a war against the elves. Our races have their differences, but Vrakas bade us protect the elves, and we have never neglected our task. Do you propose to break his commandment?
Gandalgar fixed the one-armed counselor with a furious glare. Melendalin had sabotaged his plans for vengeance, and nothing he could say would mend the damage. Through the silence, he heard Bislapur grinding his teeth.
The Elfa are no friends of mine,
he said at last.
No, this is about seizing our opportunity. Once the elves are defeated, I will lead our armies to victory against the perished land. Teon's minions have plagued Girdlygard for too long. The dwarves shall triumph where humans have failed.
You surprise me, King Gandalgar,
said Melendalin, an expression of open bewilderment spreading over his age and experience-lined face.
Surely you don't mean to defy the commands of our god. It seems to me your reason has been subdued by hatred.
He paused and eyed Bislapur suspiciously.
Unless false counsel is to blame.
The delegates shuffled and muttered, until a secondling from the clan of the Bear Hands rose to his feet.
In my opinion, the matter is worthy of debate,
he said firmly.
What if the document speaks the truth? Once a traitor, always a traitor. The elves might leave their crumbling kingdom and found a new settlement by seizing human land. What if they betray another of our folks?
The speaker, a chieftain of the same clan, leapt up, burning with zeal.
The pointy ears will stoop to any level. I can't say whether or not they murdered the fifthlings, but they should be punished all the same.
He left his place and stood alongside Gandagar in a public show of support.
You may be a fourthling, but I stand by your cause.
Shouts of approval sounded from the benches. The dwarves' low voices rumbled through the chamber until all that could be heard was a single word. War. Belendolin's calls for order were drowned out by the noise. Gandagar sat back and exchanged satisfied looks with his advisor.
Gurdlegard will soon be free of elves.
At that moment, an almighty bang rocked the hall.
Silence!
A voice thundered sternly through the din. The delegates turned in astonishment. Crown on his snowy head, Gundrabur stood perfectly erect before them, the ceremonial hammer in one hand. He had swung it against the throne so furiously that the marble revealed deep cracks. His eyes showed no sign of age, only recrimination, as he looked down at the chieftains and elders. No dwarf was more majestic, more imposing than he. His former weakness and frailty had vanished, driven out by rage. His white beard rippled as he raised his head.
Short-sighted fools! You should be worrying about Gurdlegard, not settling old scores. Any race that pits itself against the perished land is our ally. The longer the elves can repel the powers of darkness, the better.
His gaze fell on Gandagar.
You are young and impetuous, king of the Fourthlings. Two of your kin were slain by elves, and for that I am prepared to excuse your misguided call to arms. The rest of you should know better. Instead of indulging him in this lunacy, you should be voices of reason.
Gundrabur scanned the assembly.
The time has come to bury our grievances. An alliance is what we need, what I desire. The elves of Alandur, the seven human sovereigns, the six Magi, and the dwarven folks must stand united to repel the perished land.
Just then the hammer fell from his grasp and crashed to the floor, chipping the flagstones. The High King swayed and sank backward into his throne, his breath coming in short gasps. Belendolin instructed the delegates to retire to their chambers and await his summons.
We shall resume our meeting when the High King has recovered.
The representatives from the various clans filed out silently, Gundrabur's words still echoing in their minds. Bislapur cast a scornful look at the wheezing figure on the throne.
He won't last much longer,
he muttered to Gandagar as they made their way out.
When his voice dries up entirely, we'll have the chieftains on our side. They were ready to join us before the High King interrupted.
Gundrabur's chosen successor made no reply. Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Gurdlegard, Spring, 6234th Solar Cycle. Jolassin sped through the underground vaults, followed by the panting Tungdil on his considerably shorter legs. They hurried down a gallery past oak-paneled doors leading to classrooms where young apprentices were taking lessons from more senior Famuli. Only four students were taught by Lot Ionin himself, one of whom would be chosen to inherit his academy, his underground vaults, and his realm. On reaching the laboratory, Jolassin stopped abruptly and flung open the door. Small clouds of white smoke wafted toward them, creating an artificial fog.
"Get a move on!"
he barked at Tungdil, who was racing to catch up. Breathing heavily, the dwarf stepped into the chamber and was instantly wreathed in mist.
"Watch your manners, Jolassin, or you'll be fixing the problem yourself." "Climb up the flue,"
the Famulus ordered tersely, propelling Tungdil across the room.
"Something's blocking the chimney."
Suddenly the fireplace appeared out of nowhere, and beside it a bucket, which seemed to contain the source of the smoke.
"I thought you were one of Lot Ionan's best apprentices. Wouldn't a bit of magic do the trick?" "I'm asking you to fix it,"
the Famulus said firmly.
"What would a dwarf know of sorcery? You're wasting everyone's time. My pupils can't see a thing in here."
There was some low coughing and a clearing of throats.
"What's the magic word?" "Pardon? I should have thought a wizard would have a bit more charm."
Jolassin scowled.
Please.
Tungdil grinned, picked up the poker, and hooked it through his belt.
And as if by magic?
He stepped into the fireplace, where the embers had faded to a weak red glow. A quick upward glance confirmed that a thick layer of opaque smoke had sealed the chimney like a screen. Climbing confidently, he set about scaling the flue. The soot was slippery, but his fingers found easy purchase on the uneven brickwork, and he hauled himself up, rising slowly but steadily, one, two, three paces, until the hearth disappeared beneath him amid the smoke. He reached up and nudged something with his fingers.
"I think there's a nest up here! It must have fallen into the chimney!"
he called down.
"Then get rid of it! I was hardly going to lay an egg in it!"
He braced himself against the wall of the chimney, took hold of the offending twigs with one hand, and gave them a vigorous shake. The nest came free. At that moment, he received an unpleasant surprise. A torrent shot toward him, drenching him in a foul-smelling liquid that stung his eyes and his skin, followed soon after by a cloud of delicate feathers that tickled his face and his nose. Overcome with the urge to sneeze, he let go of the brickwork and fell. Tungdil had the good fortune not to graze himself on any of the jutting bricks, sustaining nothing more serious than a few nasty knocks to the chest and landing in the remains of the nest, whose twigs had ignited among the embers. Clouds of ash fell around him and coated him in fine grey soot. He sprang up, fearful of burning his bottom, but the hot embers had already scorched through his breeches. The raucous laughter left him in no doubt that he was the victim of a malicious joke. At once the clouds cleared miraculously, so the class of 20 young Famuli could observe the humiliated and dishevelled dwarf. Jolassin was leading the general merriment, and slapping his thighs in glee.
"Help! The stunted soot man is here to get us!" he cried in mock horror.
"He stole the elixir from the skunk bird's nest!"
one of his pupils jeered.
"You never know, it might be his natural smell!"
said Jolassin, dissolving into laughter all over again. He turned to Tungdil.
"All right, midget, I've had my fun, you can go."
The dwarf wiped his face on his sleeve. His head was crowned with ash and feathers, but now it shrank menacingly into his shoulders and his eyes flashed with rage.
"You think this is funny, do you?" he growled grimly. "Let's see if you laugh at this!"
He made a grab for the bucket, which felt cool to the touch, giving him all the encouragement he needed to hurl its contents. He raised his arm and took aim at the Famulus, who had turned his back and was joking with his pupils. A warning shout alerted Jolassin to the threat. Whirling round, the quick-thinking Famulus saw the contents of the bucket flying toward him and raised his hands to ward off the water with a spell. In a flash, the droplets turned to shards of ice and flew past him without drenching his freshly changed robes. The tactic worked, but at a price, as the assembled Famuli realized from the sound of tinkling glass. The hailstorm had passed over their heads, only to land among the neat rows of phials whose contents, elixirs, balms, extracts, and essences, were used in all manner of spells. The containers shattered. Already, the potions were seeping from the broken phials and mingling in pools on the shelves. The mixtures crackled and hissed ominously.
"You fool!"
scolded Jolassin, pale with fear. The dwarf bridled.
"Don't look at me!"
he retorted indignantly.
"You're the one who turned the water into ice!"
Just then, a shelf collapsed, and a flurry of sparks shot to the ceiling, exploding in a flash of red light. Something was brewing in the laboratory, this time quite literally. Some of the pupils decided that enough was enough, and ran for the door. Jolassin darted after them.
"This is all your fault! Lot Ionin will be sorry he ever took you in! You won't be here for much longer, dwarf! Not if I can help it!"
he shouted furiously, slamming the door as he left.
"If you don't let me out of here this instant, I'll strap you to my anvil and beat you with a red-hot hammer!"
threatened Tungdil as he rattled the handle in vain. He suspected that Jolassin had placed a spell on the door and locked him inside to take the blame.
"You won't get away with this!"
The dwarf ducked as something exploded behind him. Looking up, he scanned the room hurriedly for somewhere to shelter until he was released. Beroin's Folk, Secondling Kingdom, Gerdlegard, Winter, 6233rd Solar Cycle. Balendilin watched in concern as the last of the delegates filed out of the hall. The meeting of the assembly had taken an unexpected and unwelcome turn. It was a serious setback for the High King's hopes of uniting the peoples of Gerdlegard in a grand alliance against the perished land.
"Please, Vrakas, make that obdurate fourthling see sense," he prayed fretfully.
Once the hall had emptied, Gundrabur extended his hand shakily and reached for Balendilin's arm.
"Our planning will come to nothing," he said dully. "The young king of Goimdil's folk lacks experience."
With a weak smile, he squeezed his counselor's fingers.
"Well, maybe he needs a wise advisor, my loyal friend."
He struggled upright and reached for his gleaming crown. His right hand, which moments earlier had wielded the heavy hammer, trembled as he lifted the finely wrought metal from his head.
"A war," he muttered despondently. "A war against the elves. What can Gandogar be thinking?"
"Precisely nothing," his counselor replied bitterly. "That's the problem. There's no point reasoning with Gandogar or his advisor. I don't believe in their mysterious parchment for a moment. It's a forgery, I'm sure, written with the intention of winning support for a war that—"
"It served its purpose," the High King reminded him. "The damage has been done. You know how headstrong the chieftains can be. Some of them are itching to go to war with the elves, regardless of whether the document was faked."
"True, Your Majesty, but some of the Forflings seem rather more reticent. Gandogar's victory is by no means assured. The matter will be decided by a vote, with each chieftain following his conscience. We must convince the clans of both folks of the merit of our argument."
The two dwarves fell silent. A more lasting solution was needed to prevent Gandogar from reviving his plans for war at a later date. Once he was crowned High King, he would be able to implement his scheme with little or no resistance. Neither Gundrabur nor Balendilin was worried about the military might of the elves. The dwarves' traditional enemy was considerably weakened, having suffered serious losses in the ongoing battle against the Elfar, who profited from reinforcements streaming into Gerdlegard via the northern pass. In the event of a war, the elven army would be easily defeated, but casualties would be inflicted on both sides, and any loss of life among the children of the smith would leave the gates of Gerdlegard vulnerable to attack. Gundrabur's gaze roved across the deserted chamber.
"The Great Hall has seen happier times, times of unity and cohesion."
He bowed his head.
"Those times are over. Our hopes of forging a great alliance have come to nothing."
"A great alliance."
Deep in thought, Balendilin stared at the five stelae at the foot of the throne. The stone slabs were engraved with the sacred laws of the dwarves, including the name of a folk with whom the others would have no truck. Lorimbur's dwarves in the Thirdling Kingdom to the east.
"For the sake of an alliance, I would do the unthinkable and invite the Thirdlings to join our assembly,"
the High King sighed.
"In times such as these, old animosities must be forgotten. We're all dwarves, after all, and kinship is what counts."
The counselor was in no doubt that Gerdlegard needed every axe that could cleave an orcish skull, but he also knew his fellow dwarves too well.
"After Gandogar's rabble-rousing, the assembly will be in no mood for appeasement."
"Perhaps you're right, Balendilin. I know our vision of a united and unstoppable dwarven army is fading, but we cannot permit the assembly to sanction a war against the elves. We must convince the delegates that attacking Alandor would be foolhardy."
The High King's voice sounded weaker than ever.
"We need more time."
"The timing depends on you," his counselor said gently. "Gandogar will not ascend the throne while you are strong enough to rule."
"No one should rely on the failing fires of a dying king."
Gundrabur smoothed his beard.
"We need something more decisive. We shall use the dwarven laws to silence the warmongers and put a stop to the matter once and for all."
He descended the throne, negotiating the steps with utmost concentration. Every movement was small and considered, but at last he reached the stelae. Balendilin was at his side in an instant to offer him a steadying arm. Golden sunlight poured through the slits carved into the rock, illuminating every flourish of the runes. Gundrabur's weak eyes scanned the symbols.
Gandalgar is certain to be elected,
he muttered absently.
But if my memory serves me correctly, there is a way of delaying the succession. It will buy us some time so we can talk to the chieftains and strive for peace and an alliance with the elves.
His eyesight had dimmed with the cycles, and was now so poor that he was forced to stand with his nose almost touching the stone. The law stated that the throne, currently occupied by a dwarf of Beroween, should pass to one of Goimdil's folk. On that basis, Gandagar's succession was secure. Tradition dictated that the heir should stake his claim and be elected by the assembly, unless there was reason to contest the appointment.
I'm sure it's here somewhere,
he murmured to himself, fingertips gliding across the stone. His efforts were rewarded. With a sigh of relief, he closed his eyes and pressed his brow against the cold tablet whose surface had been engraved long before he was born.
After such a wretched beginning, the orbit has taken a turn for the better. Listen to this.
He straightened up and ran a crooked index finger over the all-important words.
Should the folk in question produce more than one possible heir, the clans of that folk must confer among themselves and decide on a candidate before presenting their preferred successor to the assembly,
he finished in a satisfied tone. His counselor read the passage again, fiddling excitedly with the trinkets in his graying beard. There was nothing to say that the chosen candidate would be the existing monarch. Any dwarf could stake a claim. Accordingly, a dwarf of any rank may be elected High King, provided he has the support of his kinsfolk. Belendalin saw what his sovereign had in mind.
But who would challenge Gandagar? He asked. The Fourthling clans are in agreement. To be sure, there are those who doubt their king, but...
He stopped, baffled by the look of satisfaction on the High King's craggy face. Or is there such a dwarf?
No,
Gundrabur answered with a wily smile, thinking of the letter that had been sent to him several orbits ago.
Not yet, but there will be.
Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Girdlegard, Spring, 6234th Solar Cycle. There was almost nothing left in the candle holders on Lot Ionin's desk. The flickering light and short stumps of wax were sure signs that the Magus had been in his study for hours, although it seemed to him that only minutes had elapsed. He leaned awkwardly over the parchment, poring over the closely written runes. Inscribing the magic formula had consumed countless orbits, even cycles of his time. There was one last symbol to be added. Then the charm would be complete. He smiled. Most mortals had no experience of the mystic arts and were suspicious of magic in any form. For simple souls, the constellation of the elements was a mysterious business. But for Lot Ionin, the sorcery that drove fear into the heart of peasants was nothing more than the logical outcome of elaborate sequences of gestures and words. It was one such sequence that occupied him now. Everything had to be exactly right. One wrong syllable, a single character out of place, an imprecise gesture, a hurried movement of his staff, or even a sloppily drawn circle could ruin a spell or unleash a catastrophe. The Magus could name any number of occasions when his pupils had conjured fearsome beasts or caused themselves terrible harm because of their carelessness. It always ended the same way, with an embarrassed apology and a plea for help. He never lost patience with his formulae. Once he had been an apprentice too. Now he was a Magus. A master magician, or wizard, as some folks called him.
287 cycles.
He stopped what he was doing, hand poised above the parchment. His gaze, alert as ever, took in his creased and blotchy skin, then roved over the jumble of cupboards, cabinets, and bookshelves in search of a mirror. At length, his blue eyes came to rest on the shiny surface of a vase. He appraised the reflection. Wrinkled face, grey hair with white streaks, and a greying beard dotted with smudges of ink.
There's no denying I'm older, but am I wiser? That's the question.
His beige robes had been darned and patched 1,000 times, but he refused to be parted from them. Unlike some of his fellow Magi, he took no interest in his appearance, caring only that his garments were comfortable to wear. In one important respect, the old scholar agreed with the common people. Magic was a dangerous thing. To minimize the fallout from failed experiments, he pursued his studies in the safety of the vaults. Of course, the Magus's motives for retreating below the surface were not entirely selfless. In the calm of the vaults, he could forget about his fellow humans and their trivial concerns. He delegated the running of the realm and the settling of minor disputes to his magisters, functionaries picked expressly for the job. The enchanted realm of Ionandar stretched across the southeastern corner of Gerdlegard, covering parts of Gauragar and Eidoslane, its borders defined by a magic force field, one of six in total. Certain regions of Gerdlegard were invested with an energy that could be channeled into living beings, as the very first wizards had learned. Once transferred to a human, the energy became finite, but a person could renew his store of magic by returning to the field. No sooner had the Magi made this discovery than they seized the land, divided it into six enchanted realms, and defended the territory against existing monarchs who had no weapons to match their magic powers. Generations of rulers had been forced to accept that swathes of their kingdoms were under foreign rule. The force fields were the key to the Magi's power. The six wizards' skills and knowledge had increased over time, and now their formulae, runes, and spells were capable of working great beauty, terror, and good.
"Keep your mind on the formula,"
he chided himself. Carefully wiping the tip of his goose quill against the inkwell, he lowered it to the parchment and traced a symbol slowly on the sheet. The element of fire. Every flourish of the quill was vitally important. A second of inattention would ruin all his work. His diligence paid off. Satisfied, he rose to his feet.
"Well, old boy, you've done it," he murmured in relief.
The formula was complete. If the sequence of runes worked as he intended, he would be able to detect the presence of magic in people, creatures, or objects. But before he put the theory into practice, it was time for a little reward. Lot Ionan shuffled to one of his cabinets, the oldest of a time-worn lot, and removed a bottle from the third shelf. He glanced at the skull on the label and took a long swig. The liquid was not poisonous, in spite of the warning symbol. Experience had taught him that it was the most effective way of preventing his finest brandy from disappearing into thirsty students' throats. The precaution was by no means unwarranted. Some of his apprentices, especially the older ones, were only too partial to a drop of good liquor. Lothionen was prepared to share his learning, but not his precious drink. He had run out of barrels of this particular vintage, so the bottle was worth protecting. Just then, a powerful explosion rocked the walls of his underground chamber. Fragments of stone rained down from the ceiling and landed on his desk, while files and jars jangled in the cabinets, bouncing so violently that their stoppers struck the shelves above. Everything in the higgledy-piggledy study rattled and shook. The Magus froze in horror. The open inkwell was dancing up and down on his desk, tilting farther and farther until... Lothionen's hastily uttered incantation came too late. Ink poured over the precious manuscript, and his lovingly drawn runes were drowned in a viscous black tide. For a second, Lothionen was rooted.
"What in the name of Palantiel was that?"
His kindly face hardened as he divined the origin of the bang. Gulping down the remains of his brandy, he turned sharply and strode from the room. He raced through the shadowy galleries, practically flying past doorways and passageways, his fury at his wasted efforts increasing with every step. By the time he reached the laboratory, he was seething with rage. Half a dozen Famuli were talking in hushed voices outside the door, through which strange noises could be heard. They were evidently too afraid to go in.
"There you are, estimable Magus," Jolison began respectfully. "What a calamity! We got here too late. The dwarf slipped into the laboratory, and before we could..."
"Out of my way!"
Lot Ionan barked angrily and unbolted the door. The devastation could scarcely have been more complete if a mob of lunatic alchemists had rioted inside his precious laboratory. Equipment was floating through the air, while small fires flared and spluttered at intervals throughout the room. The shelves dripped with valuable elixirs that had burst from the phials and formed foul-smelling pools on the floor. Huddled in the corner behind an upturned cauldron was the culprit. His fingers were in his ears, and his eyes were closed tightly. Despite his singed hair and scorched beard, there could be no mistaking who he was. Tungdil Bolifar. There was another loud bang. Blue sparks shot through the air, missing the Magus by a hairbreadth.
"Explain yourself, Tungdil!"
Lotionen thundered furiously. The dwarf, who evidently couldn't hear him, said nothing.
"I'm talking to you, Tungdil Bolifar!"
the Magus bellowed as loudly as he could. Looking up in surprise, the dwarf saw the lean wizard looming menacingly above him. He struggled out from behind the cauldron.
"This wasn't my doing, estimable Magus,"
he said firmly. He shot an accusing glance at Jolison, who was standing in the doorway with his pupils, doing his best to look surprised. Lotionen wheeled on him.
"Don't look at me,"
protested Jolison with exaggerated indignation.
"I had nothing to do with it. You saw for yourself that the door was locked."
"Silence, the pair of you!"
For the first time in 10 cycles, Lotionen was in danger of losing his temper altogether. He surveyed the costly mess.
"This feuding has to stop!"
His ink-stained beard seemed to ripple with rage. The dwarf had no intention of taking any of the blame. He planted his feet firmly on the ground.
"It wasn't my fault," he said stubbornly.
The Magus was visibly struggling to regain his equilibrium. He sat down on an iron-bound chest of wood and crossed his arms.
"Listen carefully, the pair of you. I'm not interested in hearing who was responsible for this disaster. Nothing, but nothing is more infuriating than being distracted from my work. Your explosion has cost me orbits, if not an entire cycle of study. So forgive me for losing my patience. Enough is enough. I intend to restore peace to my school."
"Estimable Magus, you're not going to banish the dwarf, are you?"
exclaimed Jolison, trying to sound horrified.
"Enough! We'll discuss your part in this fiasco later. But first I need this nonsense to stop. The sooner we have peace in the vaults, the better."
He turned to Tungdil.
"An old friend gave me the use of a few items, and now he needs them back."
The dwarf braced himself.
"You, my little helper, will run the errand for me. In 1 hour I shall expect you in my study, bag packed and ready to go. I'll give you the items then. Prepare yourself for a good long walk."
The dwarf bowed politely and hurried from the room. This was far better than he had expected. A journey on foot was scarcely a chore. The paths and lanes of Girdlegard were no challenge for his sturdy legs.
"I might meet a dwarf," he thought hopefully. "If this is supposed to be a punishment, he can punish me some more."
The Magus waited until the stocky figure was out of sight before turning to Jolison.
"You wanted to land him in trouble,"
he said bluntly.
"I know what you were up to, Fumulus. There's never a moment's peace with the two of you around. Well, I've decided to put a stop to it. For the duration of Tungdil's journey, I want you peeling potatoes in the kitchen. You'll have plenty of time to regret your bad behavior and pray to Palandiel for his speedy return."
Jolison opened his mouth in protest.
"If I hear so much as a grumble from you, or the slightest criticism from Frala or the cook, you can pack your bags and leave."
The young man's jaws clamped shut.
"Oh, and before you start your stint in the kitchen, you can clean up here."
The Magus waved at the mess that had once been his laboratory. He shooed the remaining Famuli from the room. On his way out, he picked up a broom from the corner and pressed it into Jolison's hands.
"Don't get anyone to do your dirty work for you,"
he said, marching to the door.
"Make sure it's tidy, and by tidy I mean absolutely spick and span."
He slammed the door, and the bolt rattled home. Chapter 2 Berowyn's Folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, Winter, 6233rd Solar Cycle. It was time for the High King to initiate his counselor into the plan. He handed him a letter.
"It's from the Magus of Ionandar. Lot Ionin the Forbearing, they call him in his realm."
Belendalin knew the Magus by reputation. His school lay in the east of Girdlegard, and he was said to prize his solitude. Apparently he spent most of his time studying in his underground vaults, inventing new charms and formulae, far from the worries of everyday life.
He sends news of something most unusual, a dwarf,
the High King explained.
The only dwarf in Ionandar, no less. He says he found him many cycles ago, under peculiar circumstances, and raised him in his realm. He wants to know whether any of our clans are missing a kinsman. He is eager to reunite him with his kind.
Belendolin skimmed the letter. What do we know of the dwarf?
The matter is mysterious but intriguing. To my knowledge, no child has been lost in the past 200 cycles.
And it's your intention to present the sorcerer's ward as a long-lost heir to the throne? The counselor laid the letter on the table. But how? He asked doubtfully. A dwarf raised by Longans won't know what it means to be a child of the smith. The Fourthlings will never back him, especially not without proof of his lineage. The High King shuffled to the conference table and lowered himself onto the second Ling Monarch's chair before his legs gave way beneath him.
I expect you're right,
he said in a strained voice.
Be that as it may, they can't do a thing until the candidate is here and the matter has been resolved. Even if I die, their hands will be tied.
He looked squarely at his counselor.
If Vrakas should smite me with his hammer before the dwarf arrives, you must bear the burden of preventing war and preserving our kinsfolk.
Belendolin pursed his lips. Your Majesty won't be leaving us yet, not when your inner furnace still burns strong.
You're a miserable liar, like all dwarves.
Gundrabur laughed and laid a hand on his shoulder.
But from now on, we must speak with false tongues in order to protect our kinsfolk from a war that could destroy them. You and I will fib like kobolds, Belendolin. For once, we must make it our business to drive a wedge between the clans. Let us walk a while, and you can lend me your counsel. We shall weave a web of falsehoods around Gandogar and Bislipur and keep them from the throne until the last belligerent syllable has been squeezed from their lungs.
Belendolin helped the king to his feet. He had no faith in the plan succeeding, but he kept his misgivings to himself. Gandogar was in good spirits when he woke the next morning and was summoned with the other delegates to the Great Hall. Proceedings were about to recommence, and he felt confident that the High King would name him as his successor, after which the members of the Assembly would endorse his choice with their votes. It was as good as decided already. Gundrabur's plea for peace had rankled with him, but he no longer held a grudge. The aged dwarf's long reign had produced nothing worthy of posterity, and he was destined to be forgotten before too long. It wasn't dignified to quarrel with a dying king. Gandogar entered the hall and sat down, while Bislipur took up position behind him. The pews filled quickly as the chieftains and elders filed in. A few of the delegates looked at him encouragingly and rapped their axe heads. Far from being threatening, the gesture was a sign of support. Gandogar noticed an unusual trinket hanging from the neck of a secondling chieftain. He strained his eyes to take a closer look. The shriveled trophy was an elven ear worn with obvious pride by the chieftain, who nevertheless tucked it hurriedly under his mail as soon as the High King's arrival was announced. It was still too early for open displays of aggression toward a protected race. Gundrabur appeared at the door, his sprightly appearance belying rumors of his impending death. Gandagar felt a wave of disappointment at seeing the High King in such excellent form, then immediately felt guilty for harboring such dreadful thoughts. He didn't actually want the old chap to die. It was just that Gundrabur's disapproving speech of the previous orbit had struck a raw nerve. Tunics of mail creaked and rasped as the delegates went down on one knee to greet the High King. Axes on high, they signaled their unwavering devotion and their willingness to live and die as he decreed. Gundrabur answered by lifting the ceremonial hammer and bringing it down smartly. The delegates were free to rise, which they did, amid much clunking of armor. Belendolin stepped forward and turned his earnest brown gaze on Gandogar.
Gandogar Silverbeard of the Clan of the Silverbeards, ruler of the Fourthlings and head of Goimdil's line. Are you ready to assert your claim to the High King's throne?
He said ceremoniously. Gandogar rose from his seat, pulled his axe from his belt and laid it on the table.
"Unyielding as the rock from which we were created, and keen as this blade is my will to defend our race against its foes,"
came his solemn reply. Such was his inner turmoil that he failed to notice that Belendilin, not the High King, had taken charge of the proceedings. It occurred to him when the counselor cut in before he could continue.
"King Gandogar, the Assembly has heard and noted your claim. A decision will be taken when we have heard the second candidate speak. You and he must decide which of the two of you will withdraw. Until then, we must wait."
"Wait!"
bellowed Gandogar, blood rushing to his head. He turned to search the faces of his chieftains, all of whom seemed genuinely surprised.
"Who was it?"
he thundered.
"Which of you had the audacity to go behind my back? Step forward and make yourself known."
He reached for his axe, but was stayed by Belendilin.
"You do your kinsfolk an injustice," said the counselor. "Your rival is not here."
He produced a letter and held it up for all to see.
"The dwarf in question was separated many cycles ago from his folk. He is mindful of his heritage and has announced his return. He lives in Ionandar and is preparing to join us as we speak."
"Ionandar?"
Gandagar exclaimed incredulously.
"Vrakas, forgive me, but what kind of dwarf lives with sorcerers?"
He drew himself up.
"Is this some kind of a joke? A stranger writes a letter that you accept without question, and now the ceremony must be delayed? What name does he go by?"
"His name is of no account. He was raised as a foundling and named by humans. But the items discovered with him show him to be a member of your folk."
"Hogwash!"
Gandagar retorted angrily.
"The letter is a fake!" "And what of the document purporting to tell the truth about the elves?"
Melendolin said sternly, one hand resting lightly on his belt.
"Silence, both of you!"
The High King levered himself from his throne.
"King Gandogar, do you presume to call my counselor a liar?"
The old dwarf was powerful and majestic in his fury, his words thundering through the lofty hall. The Fourthling monarch sounded shrill and petty as a fishwife by comparison.
"You will abide by my decision. When the candidate arrives, the Fourthling chieftains will decide which of you will make the better king."
Gandagar pointed to his retinue.
"Why the delay? Ask the chieftains now and you shall hear whom they elect. Their minds are made up. How could a stranger—"
The High King raised a wizened hand.
"No!"
He waved toward the engraved stelae.
"We will follow the law as it was given to us by our forefathers. What they ordained will be fulfilled."
The silence that descended on the vast hall was by no means uniform in quality. For the most part it was born of astonishment, but in a number of cases it was prompted by helplessness and rage. There was no choice but to wait for the audacious stranger to appear. Gandagar sat down heavily and pulled his axe across the table toward him. The blade left a deep white gouge in the polished stone, scarring the surface over which the masons had toiled so long.
"So be it," he said coolly.
He dared not risk a longer speech, for fear that he would say something he might regret. Turning, he cast an abject glance at Bislipur, who seemed a model of composure, but whose unruffled expression Gandagar could read. His advisor was already turning over the situation in his mind, searching for a solution. Bislipur could be relied on to be resourceful.
"The journey from Ionandar will take weeks. How are we supposed to occupy ourselves until the dwarf arrives?"
asked Gandagar, eyes fixed on the sparkling diamonds on his armor.
"What makes you think that our aspiring High King will find us?"
"Or that he'll make it here alive,"
added Bislipur.
"We'll have plenty to discuss in the meantime," said Belendilin. "The Assembly will turn to matters of imminent importance for our clans."
He smiled.
"But your concern is touching. Rest assured that the dwarf will get here safely. We've sent an escort."
"In that case, we should send one too,"
Bislipur insisted with forced benevolence.
"The Fourthlings are always happy to look after their own. Where should we send our warriors?"
"Your offer is most generous, but unnecessary. The dwarf will be a guest of the High King, so the High King has sent warriors of his own,"
Belendilin said diplomatically.
Given the stormy start to the proceedings, I suggest we take a break and cool our tempers with a keg of dark ale."
He raised his axe and rapped the pole twice against the table. The clear ring of metal on stone sang through the air and echoed through the corridors. At once, barrels of dark roasted barley malt were rolled into the hall, and in no time the delegates were raising their drinking horns to the reigning High King and his successor, who most assumed would be Gandagar. Bislapur laid his hand on his monarch's shoulder.
"Patience, Your Majesty. Let us honor our forefathers by satisfying every requirement they name. It's important we don't give anyone the opportunity to question the legitimacy of your reign."
They clinked tankards, and he took a lengthy draught. The beer was thick and malty, almost sweet.
"Ale like this can be brewed only by dwarves."
He smiled, wiping the foam from his beard. At length, the atmosphere in the great hall became jollier and more boisterous, and Bislapur could slip away unnoticed. Safely ensconced in a lonely passageway, he summoned Sverd and entrusted the gnome with a mission of great importance. Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Gerdlegard, Spring, 6234th Solar Cycle. Whistling, Tungdil knelt by his cupboard and packed his large leather knapsack for the trip. He took a tinderbox, a flint, and a blanket in case he had to spend a night in the open, as well as his fishing hook, a plate, and some cutlery. His cloak he rolled into a bundle and fastened to the outside of the knapsack with a leather strap. Lastly, he pulled on his chainmail and tweaked it with practiced movements until it lay flat against his skin. He felt instantly better. There was something safe and incredibly homely about his shirt of steel rings. His attachment to his chainmail was a matter of instinct, not something he could explain. He had the same feeling when he was working at the anvil. Routine jobs, forging horseshoes, nails, and iron brackets for doors, honing blades or sharpening tools, came naturally to him. It was his dwarven blood, he supposed. Hoisting his bulging knapsack to his shoulders, he picked up the axe that had been given to him by Lot Ionen, hooked it through his belt, and set off for the Magus's study. He knew the vaults like the back of his hand. The dim light posed no problem for his sharp dwarven eyes, and his sense of direction never abandoned him underground. No two tunnels looked the same to him, owing to his ability to remember the slightest irregularity in the rock. It was a different story on the surface, where he was unable to find his way anywhere without a map. He knocked briskly and opened the door. Lot Ionen was sitting at his desk, dressed in the old beige robes to which he was so attached. He held up a sheet of parchment accusingly as the dwarf came into the room.
"Do you see this, Tungdil?"
he said, throwing the paper disgustedly back onto the pile.
"This is your doing. Orbits of study destroyed in the blink of an eye."
I had no idea,"
the dwarf said with genuine contrition, but determined not to concede any guilt. Stubbornness was another of his inherited characteristics.
"I know, Tungdil, I know."
The Magus's expression softened.
"Go on then, what really happened?"
"It was another of Jolassin's pranks. He played a trick on me, so I threw a bucket of water at him."
He bowed his head and his voice fell to an indistinct mumble.
"He turned the droplets into ice and the shards hit some of the files. He tried to lay the blame on me by locking me in the laboratory."
He looked up and focused his brown eyes on his patron. The Magus sighed.
"Six of one and half a dozen of the other. Just as I thought. Still, I shouldn't have shouted at you like that."
He motioned to the parchment.
"Of course, it doesn't change the fact that I'll be spending the next few orbits re-inscribing these runes. You had no business to be in the laboratory, Tungdil. No good comes of a dwarf meddling in magic or mixing potions. I thought you knew that by now."
"But it wasn't my—"
"What possessed you to take matters into your own hands? You had only to come to me and Jolassin would have been punished. I'm sending you on a journey. A long journey. Which isn't to say I won't be pleased to have you back. On the contrary."
He paused.
"Rest assured that Jolassin has fared much worse. He'll be peeling potatoes until you're home. And should you decide to take a more circuitous route—"
With a mischievous grin, he left the rest up to Tungdil.
"Well, are you ready?"
"Yes, estimable Magus,"
Tungdil answered, relieved that his patron no longer held him solely to blame.
What would you have me do?
After the frayed tempers of the laboratory, the atmosphere in the study, where they were surrounded by the clutter of Lot Ionan's cabinets, gadgetry, and books, seemed all the more relaxed. Flames crackled softly in the fireplace, and the Magus's owl was napping in a corner.
We'll discuss your errand later. All in good time.
Lot Ionan rose and retired with his steaming mug to the wing chair by the hearth. He stretched his slippered feet toward the flames.
There's no rush. Jollison will be busy in the laboratory for a good while longer. Besides, there's something I'd like you to consider while you're away.
His hand patted the chair beside him. Tungdil set down his knapsack and took a seat. It sounded as though the Magus had something important to say.
I've been thinking.
Lot Ionan cleared his throat.
The two of us have known each other for 62 of your 63 cycles.
The dwarf knew what was coming. At times like this, when the mood was sentimental and the Magus was feeling relaxed, he would pour himself a draught of beer, warm his feet by the fire, and journey into the distant past, recalling events that had happened over a human lifetime ago. Tungdil loved these conversations.
It was winter, and the winds were howling, when there was a knock on the door, and a band of kobolds deposited a bundle.
He looked his ward in the eye and laughed softly.
It was you. Back then, without your beard, you could have almost been mistaken for a human bairn. They threatened to drown you in the nearest river if I didn't pay your bond. What could I do? I gave them their money and raised you myself.
For which I shall be eternally grateful, Tungdil said softly.
Yes, well, eternally.
The Magus fell silent for a moment.
It seems to me that it might be time to let you go your own way.
He laid a hand on the dwarf's thick shock of hair.
I've outlived my natural span, and you've served me so loyally that your debt of gratitude, if ever there was one, has been repaid. Besides, if I don't come up with a more convincing charm against old age, my soul will be summoned to Palandio.
Tungdil didn't like to be reminded that human existence was inescapably brief, even for the likes of the powerful Magus.
I'm sure you'll find a way, he said hoarsely. Didn't you want to tell me something?
The dwarf's clumsy attempt to change the subject brought a wry smile to Lot Ionan's face.
You were left here at your parents' behest because they wanted you to be the greatest wizard of the dwarven race. Or at least that's what I told you. You saw through the story soon enough. Once I taught you to read, you learned enough about your kinsfolk to know it wasn't true.
Dwarves aren't fond of magic, and magic isn't fond of them.
Tungdil couldn't help smiling. His hands were best suited to wielding a hammer, and he could happily clutch a book from Lot Ionan's vast library, but a sorcerer's staff was another matter.
Rakus made his artisans through and through. There's no room in our hearts for magic.
Indeed,
the Magus agreed in amusement, remembering the long line of minor disasters resulting from Tungdil's accidental encounters with the occult.
But you're too modest. You've crammed your head with knowledge like a scholar. You know more about the peoples of Gerdlegard than some of my pupils.
Oh, the credit is all yours, Lot Ionan. You even schooled me in rhetoric.
And that was no small feat. Adhering to the proper rules of disputation is a challenge for the obstinate tongue of a dwarf.
His face became serious.
I still curse myself for not asking the kobolds where they found you. At least then I'd be able to tell you which clan you belong to.
He reached down to the floor and rummaged through a stack of papers to produce a map of Gerdlegard, which he carefully unfurled.
I've sent word to Beroween's folk,
he said, pointing his index finger at the Secondling Kingdom.
Perhaps they'll know something of the circumstances surrounding your birth. Given the ripe old age you dwarves can get to, there's a reasonable chance your parents are still alive. Well, Tungdil, what do you say?
The dwarf was visibly moved. His dream of meeting his clansfolk was on the cusp of being fulfilled.
Oh, thank you, Lot Ionan,
he said, overcome with excitement.
Have the Secondlings replied?
Lot Ionan was delighted to see his enthusiasm.
Not yet, but I'm sure they'll be intrigued by the news of a lost dwarf. They'll be in touch. You can count on it. It's only a start, though. You shouldn't get your hopes up yet.
I can't thank you enough, Tungdil said solemnly, still struggling to put his emotions into words.
Now that we've got the map out, I may as well show you where you're going.
Lot Ionan traced a route from the underground vaults through Idaslane, across the border and into the kingdom of Gauragar. His finger stopped just short of the enchanted realm of Leos Nudin, home of the powerful Magus Nudin the Knowledge Lusty, and came to rest over a peak named the Black Saddle.
There you have it. 300 miles on a northwesterly bearing. The paths are well marked, and I'll give you the map to take with you, of course. Failing that, you can always stop for directions in one of the villages on the way.
He rolled up the parchment.
As for your errand, I need you to convey a few items to my good friend Gorin. If you look in the ebony cabinet, you'll find a small leather bag with green drawstrings. I borrowed the contents for an experiment many years ago, and their purpose has been served. The coins on the table are for you to take.
While Tungdil was scrabbling in the cupboard, Lot Ionan leafed through a book, pretending to read. The dwarf pulled out a bag.
Found it, he said finally.
You should go then, Tungdil, but remember to reflect on our earlier conversation. If we find your family, you'll be free to join them, or remain with me, as you please,
he said without looking up from his tome. Tungdil turned to the door.
And one last thing. Be careful. Keep an eye on the bag and don't lose it. Its contents are valuable, he warned.
At last he glanced up and smiled.
I strongly advise you not to open it. We don't want any mishaps while you're away. Palandia'll be with you. And Vrakas too.
You can depend on me, Lot Ionan.
I know I can, Tungdil. Now enjoy your trip, and come back safely.
On leaving Lot Ionan's study, Tungdil steered a course for the kitchens to stock up on victuals and tell Frala of the news. He found her working at the large dough trough. The stodgy mix of flour, water, and yeast took considerable effort to knead, and her face glistened with sweat from the exertion.
I need provisions, he announced with a grin. The Magus is sending you on an errand, is he?
Frala smiled and gave the dough a final vigorous squeeze.
I'm sure we'll find something in the larder for Lot Ionan's special envoy.
She dusted her hands and led the way into a small room that Tungdil imagined was the closest thing to seventh heaven for a mouse. Frala filled his knapsack with cured meat, cheese, sausage, and a loaf of rye bread.
There, she said. That should keep you going.
Not for 300 miles, it won't.
300? She exclaimed in surprise. Tungdil, that's not an errand. It's a serious journey. You'll need more food than that.
She added 2 large sausages and some ham.
But don't let cook see, she said, buckling the flap hastily.
They returned to the kitchen.
Aren't you going to tell me where you're going? She asked impatiently.
The Black Saddle. The Magus wants me to deliver a few items to one of his old apprentices.
The Black Saddle, Frala echoed thoughtfully. I've never heard of it. But 300 miles is an awfully long way. Which kingdoms will you pass through?
Tungdil chuckled.
I'd take you with me and show you, but I don't think Lot Ionan would approve.
Not to mention your husband and daughters. He showed her the map and traced his finger along the route.
Through Idaslane and Gauragar? And Leos Nudin is barely a stone's throw away. Aren't you curious to visit?
She exclaimed in excitement.
Not much happens in Leos Nudin, Tungdil said dismissively.
Nudin the Knowledge Lusty does nothing but study.
But Turguria would be worth a look. Why's that?
Turgur the Fair-Faced is on a quest for universal beauty. He wants to make everyone into paragons of elven grace, even bow-legged farmers and squinty-eyed maids. From what Lot Ionan told me, he hasn't quite perfected his spells. Apparently, his experiments have led to such deformities that some of his subjects are too ashamed to leave their homes. It's probably a good thing I won't be going there. What if Turgur took it into his head to magic me to human size?
What a dreadful thought, said Frala with feeling.
She stooped to embrace the dwarf.
May Palandiel and Vrakas bless you and keep you from harm.
Before he knew it, she had unknotted her scarf and tied it round his waist.
Here, now you'll have a talisman too.
Her eyes twinkled mischievously.
It'll remind you of me, and you'll have no excuse for forgetting my present. Tungdil looked into her lively green eyes and sighed. He was so fond of Frala that it was hard to imagine life without her in a dwarven kingdom, especially now that he was guardian to Sunya and Ikana. His attachment to her was not in the least bit romantic. He felt bound to her like a brother, having known her since she was a child. Lotayonan wrote to the dwarves of Beruin, he said, proceeding to recount his conversation with the Magus. He wants to find out where I came from. If the Secondlings know my kin, I'd like to visit them in the mountains, maybe move there. The Magus said I was free to choose. The maid embraced him once more.
It looks as though your dream is coming true, she congratulated him.
She smiled mischievously.
Jolassin will jump for joy if you decide to go.
Well, maybe I should stay then, threatened Tangdil.
A shadow came over her face.
You won't forget to come back and visit us, will you? I'd like to hear about the dwarves of the south, she said,
her voice tinged with melancholy, in spite of her genuine pleasure at the news.
Frala, who knows if I even belong there? They might not know anything about me. I could have been hewn from the mountain without any kin.
In any case, my first priority is Gurine. I'll see what happens after that.
A wail went up from the cot in the corner. Frala hurried to comfort Ikana, who had been sleeping snugly by the hearth.
Say hello to your guardian, little one, she told her daughter. He'll always be here for you, just as he's always been here for me.
The baby grabbed the dwarf's outstretched finger and pulled. Tungdil was almost certain that he heard a soft chuckle.
She's laughing at me. Nonsense, she's laughing with you. She likes you, see?
Don't worry, Tungdil promised the baby. I'll buy presents for you, and your sister too.
He disengaged his calloused finger from her delicate pink hands. Now that Ikana no longer seemed so fragile, he would have liked to stay and play. She reached up and tugged a strand of his hair. He carefully loosened her grip.
So you want me to stay, do you?
The trio made their way through the shadowy galleries to the northern exit. Sunlight seeped through the cracks in the doorway. Frala kissed him on the forehead.
Look after yourself, Tungdil, she said, and come back safe and sound.
A famulus pulled on a rope to open the door, and the iron-bound oak panels parted with a groan. Outside, the rolling grassy hills, bright flowers and leafy trees were dappled with sunshine. The aroma of warm soil wafted in on the breeze.